Welcome back to the Indie Vets Happy Hour. I am your host, as always, Dr. Andrew Heller, DVM. I'm here with my co-host, Marissa Brunetti.
VMD.
VMD it is. And we are back for our second session of, what are we calling this thing? Do we have a name for it?
There's no I in team, but there's an I in Indie Vets.
All right, still workshopping that one. So we're back with Dr. Casey Robinson, our very own area medical director in the, I would just say the northern states, just to make it easy.
Upper Midwest in Massachusetts, that's what I'm calling it.
All right, perfect. Mm-hmm. If you want more of his background, definitely tune into the previous episode where we talked about glaucoma and he gave us a really thorough do's and don'ts and really just a great discussion on glaucoma. Certainly was a great refresher for me. And I was really interested in ophthalmology at one point, so it taught me lots of things that I didn't even know. So it was great. So today, what are we talking about, Casey?
Today, we're going to mainly be talking about KCS, or keratoconjunctivitis cica.
Before we get going on the KCS, let's talk about our beers, as usual. Casey, what are you drinking?
I am drinking Superfluid, which is a double India Pale Ale from Schwartz Brewery in Bel Air, Michigan.
So local to you.
Super solid. It's local to me. Hard to get out of, outside of Michigan, but if you happen to find yourself here and you see it, it's a banger.
Awesome. Marissa, how about you?
I took a hint from Casey last week, and my brother found Bell's Two Hearted Ale from Michigan over here in Philly. So I'm drinking that.
Awesome.
Cheers.
And for me, I am drinking something local as well. It's called Victory Summer Hazy Love. And
it definitely
stuck out to me when in the store because we're actually having our amazing event this summer at the AVMA at the Victory Brewing place that they just opened up in Philly. So anybody that's going to be in Philly for AVMA, definitely reach out to us and we'll get you on the guest list. And you can certainly come there and have a great time with us. But yeah, Hazy Love, Hazy IPA. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. So let's get into it. Let's get into it.
Who is this episode intended for?
So this is for general practitioners, 100% general practitioners. Despite the additional training, I am in no way an ophthalmologist, but certainly have a few extra pearls to offer. So definitely intended for the general practitioner. Again, when something comes in the door, especially from an ophthalmic standpoint, you're going to want to keep KCS real, real high up on your list until proven otherwise.
I also think this is great for pet owners too, right? Because sometimes KCS looks like they have a lot of tears, right? Because there's like gunk and stuff in their eye, right? And owners don't realize, one, that this is the opposite. They don't have a lot of tears. And also, secondly, that this is a lifelong disease process. And to keep corneas healthy in their pets long term, I think this is really important for pet owners.
100%. One thing I would add for pet owners too is I've had a lot of people come in and, you know, they'll be treating conjunctivitis when it's KCS, right? Like, I mean, it is keratoconjunctivitis, right. But they're just using the, you know, Neopolydex. Exactly. Like they're using their Neopolydex that they have from the last eye infection they had, right? And they don't really get the proper diagnosis. So it's really important because that's not the treatment. That's not the treatment for KCS, which we'll get to. So let's talk a little bit. Let's jump right in and talk about really what is KCS.
So at the end of the day, KCS is an inflammatory condition of the conjunctiva and the cornea due to some sort of deficiency in the precorneal tear film. Now, this is either quantitative, so they're not making enough tears, or qualitative, means their tears are not composed correctly. It's impossible to really know about or understand KCS without knowing the anatomy of the precorneal tear film.
What is the precorneal tear film?
Good question.
Oh, it's so awesome. It's three layers. So you have the outer lipid layer that's coming from the meibomian glands that are, you can actually see the openings in the eyelid margin. We frequently treat disease of the meibomian gland. Basically, I like to boil it down to that prevents evaporation of the second layer. The second layer is going to be your aqueous layer. Now, this is what everyone traditionally thinks of as tears. This is the liquid. This is the clear liquid coming from the lacrimal glands. Now, that's the primary lacrimal glands, the accessory lacrimal glands, and the third eyelid gland. This does a lot. I mean, flushes foreign material, lubricates the lids. This is what provides an abundant amount of nutrition to the cornea, including white blood cells that are very crucial in certain disease processes, makes the corneal smooth, and does have an antibacterial effect. The inner layer, I like to think of as the glue. This holds things down. This is the mucoid layer coming from the goblet cells. It basically binds the lipophobic aqueous layer to the corneal surface.
You mentioned the third eyelid contributes to the aqueous portion, correct?
Yes, correct.
What percentage of the aqueous portion comes from that? Do you know?
About a third.
About a third, okay. No, I think that's just really important because sometimes dogs have that removed, and we should talk a little bit about that at some point, but removing that's definitely going to remove part of that. A third of the aqueous, right? So
especially in breeds predisposed. I mean, removing a third eyelid gland in an English bulldog makes me wiggle.
All right, so dogs, they've got a reduction in this tear production. Is it all three? Is it one or the other? What is it that ends up causing the KCS symptoms?
So at the end of the day, KCS is going to come from increased surface friction, predispose them to bacterial infections, cause a dehydrated, malnourished cornea and conjunctiva. You can have a deficiency in all three. It just kind of tells you what type of KCS you have. You can have quantitative KCS or qualitative KCS. The one that general practitioners are going to see most of the time is going to be a quantitative. That's a deficiency in the aqueous portion of the tear film. If we have a deficiency in the lipid layer or the mucin layer, that's going to qualify as a qualitative KCS. So the tears are not, there's enough of them, they're just not composed correctly.
So is there a way to differentiate between the two?
There's a few ways. I think the best way is going to probably be diagnostically. If you have a dog that you're like a walking, talking, just really bad keratitis, you're like, this is going to be a dry eye dog for sure, but the tears are normal, I'd be thinking qualitative. In which case you do something called a tear film breakup time, which is an annoying diagnostic.
So annoying. I hate it.
So annoying. Yeah.
We'll have to look that one up later.
No, he's going to explain it to us.
In 30 minutes or less? Come on.
I think I actually, to be honest, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but
you're fine.
I do think that we don't think about qualitative enough. And that's why I'm pushing this right now, because I don't think we think about the health of the corneas of our dogs as they age enough. Like, I think it's something we kind of skip over and we're like, oh, it's easy to do a Schirmer tear test, but we always forget about this other diagnostic that you could easily do. Maybe hard to, you know, interpret, I guess, but
for sure.
But yeah.
Have you done it, Marissa?
Yeah.
I've never done the tear film breakup test.
Well, then that's why Casey's going to tell us how to do it.
It's what we're here for. So yeah, the traditional diagnostic we think of with KCS is going to be the Schirmer tear test. There's two different types of Schirmer tear tests. There's Schirmer 1 and Schirmer 2. Schirmer 1 basically measures your basal tearing and your reflex tearing. So the tearing in response to the strip being put in and just the normal amount.
Cool.
The Schirmer 2 actually involves emptying out tears from the ventral fornix with a cotton swab, numbing the eye, and actually measuring the basal tear film, as opposed, because there's going to be no reflex tearing because they can't feel it. There was a study out of Illinois years back that I believe that you can catch a KCS earlier with a Schirmer 2 as opposed to a Schirmer 1.
I've never done a Schirmer 2.
I've never done a Schirmer 2 either, but remember hearing about it.
I did them during my internship, but honestly, I can't say that I do them at all frequently in general practice.
So you're still using the same strip, you're just prepping it differently.
Yeah. It just basically involves removing existing tears, starting fresh, and numbing the eye.
So would you use like a sterile gauze and like hold it in the fornix to get rid of the residual tears and then numb the eye?
I'll use a cotton swab. I'll numb it first and then I'll use a cotton swab.
Perfect.
So you kind of just dry it.
Yeah. Because there's something called a lacrimal lake. You can actually see at the bottom, and you just want to remove that. There you go.
So wait, so curious, I think most of us know, well, you can go through this, but the Shermer tier test, you know, you're looking for a certain production. What's the number you're looking for in 1 minute on a Shermer one?
1 minute, 15 to 25.
All right, so what causes this? What causes KCS?
There's honestly a robust list of causes. You can have drug-induced. I'd say the most clinically relevant for us is going to be sulfa drugs. I was just mentioning to Andrew, you have that owner, dog with prostatic disease, 70-pound dog, can't afford Baytril. Your hands are tied. You've got to reach for the sulfa, but just informing them of that risk. It's going to resolve in about, I believe, 45 to 60 days after you stop.
Huh.
There is an NSAID that can cause it, but I've never used it, nor have I seen anyone use it, called Etodolac.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've never seen anyone use it.
There's surgical, like Andrew mentioned, removal of the third eyelid gland. Now, the most common is going to be immune-mediated, an immune-mediated lacrimal adenitis. There's idiopathic, which we never really know. Granted, I don't really know without biopsy how you can definitively diagnose lacrimal adenitis. Traumatic, that's going to be basically nervous damage, usually cranial nerve 7 or 5. Infectious, distemper is one thing. I've seen one dog with distemper during my internship, and it had really gunky eyes. Granted, it was distemper, so no one was reaching for the Shermer tear test strips, but in retrospect. And leishmaniasis, I mean, what is that, foxhounds?
Sandflies, I thought.
Sandflies.
No, it was the sandfly that transmitted it. Yeah. Locoweed is going to be a toxic cause. Now, neurogenic. I'm a huge one on neurogenic KCS because I think it's just so underdiagnosed. Again, cranial nerve 7 or 5, traditionally going to be a unilateral, and the hallmark is going to be an ipsilateral dry nose. Other ones, you can have congenital, you can have senile, and then dogs undergoing radiation for certain types of cancers.
So back to neurogenic, just quickly, I know we haven't gotten to treatments yet, but doesn't this require different treatments?
It does.
Okay.
So. Very annoying treatments. That's why if I diagnose a dog with neurogenic KCS, I am turfing that. I can't manage that effectively.
Straight to the ophthalmologist.
Right to the ophthalmologist. I'm not even giving it a go. Mm. I will tell the owner what they might have coming up for the kind of in their future, but I really don't feel comfortable managing one of those. Now, if someone said, well, I can't go, I'm going to do my best. But the treatment there is traditionally pilocarpine, which is very a very frustrating drug, I can say.
Mm. We'll get to that. I think that most people know what KCS looks like, but why don't we just talk about it briefly, if you can?
Yeah, for sure. So the classic thing that us as veterinarians are going to realize is the abnormal mucopurulin or just mucoid discharge. I like to explain it to owners, basically, especially with a quantitative tear film deficiency, that the eye is saying, I don't have enough tears. My cornea is drying out. How am I going to lubricate the cornea? The eye has one option, increase mucus production. That's the only option it has to lubricate the cornea. So that's why they get that gunky, disgusting discharge. Cornea is dry. They're going to be squinty. They're considerably predisposed to corneal ulcers, which we'll get into kind of the relationship between interpreting tests that are diagnostics and corneal ulcers in a moment.
Good one.
Absolutely. Vascularization with deposition of pigment, calcium, or lipid.
So for pet owners out there, vascularization means you're going to see veins, arteries, vessels growing on the cornea, which is not normal.
Correct. Which is a hallmark of keratitis, just inflammation of the cornea. But if you diagnose a dog with KCS, if you don't see a vessel, you're not looking hard enough. They've got to be there, or they've got to be coming in very, I mean, they're traditionally very thin vessels. Sometimes you'll see some thick ones and the chronic ones, but they're traditionally pretty fine and thin. The cornea doesn't look right. The cornea looks dry. There's no sparkle. There's no life to the cornea.
There's no sparkle.
It's got to have some flair, and it's got none.
And for pet owners out there also, I would just add, the lacrimal system also is what moistens the nose.
Yep. So the tears are going to drain through the nasal puncta, which is the pore coming out the nose, which has diagnostic value in certain scenarios. If we had more time, we would talk about the Jones test and such. But KCS day.
So we should just say Google the Jones test.
Google the Jones test. It's helpful. corneal pigmentation. Picture your pug that cannot see because its corneas are black. Keratinization. And you can just get really chronic staphylococcal blepharitis.
And that's probably why that Neopolydex sometimes helps.
Yes.
In these chronic cases, right?
Also, just in general, it's keratitis. There's an inflammatory component. Putting that corticosteroid on there will help transiently. Also, extraocular signs that you can't ignore. Always look for that dry nostril. And sometimes all that mucus production will give them like a periocular dermatitis.
Yes, I've seen that a lot.
Are there any other forms of KCS?
So some people will talk about intermittent KCS. I think it's more common than we know. And the only real way to diagnose this is going to do repeated shimmer tear tests. My understanding, it's traditionally a unilateral, sometimes seasonal condition. One thing to always look out for, and if you see this, make sure you repeat your shimmer tear test in the future. But if a dog has a corneal ulcer, imagine we get an eyelash in our eye. What are we going to do? We're going to tear. Dogs should do the same thing. If you have a dog with a corneal ulcer that has a shimmer tear test of like 15, raise your eyebrow because that should be way higher. That's a painful condition that should cause excess tearing. If the dog is not tearing excessively, at minimum, repeat your shimmer tear test after the resolution of the ulcer.
I was just going to say about doing a shimmer tear test, it's really important when you're doing your full opto exam to do that first, before you start putting drops in the eye, before you start messing with the eye, correct?
100%. And I will be the first person to tell you there have been times and I'm like, this is an ulcer, I'm going to stain it. And I get all excited, I stain it, and it's not an ulcer, and I miffed it. So just, yeah, calming down.
I've done the same thing. Yeah. I've done the same thing. Yep.
Calming down, realizing you got to do that first is important. And another, more common form of intermittent KCS is going to be your anesthetic and your sedated procedures. Mm. Plentiful evidence shows that alpha agonists and butorphanol can decrease tear production. And in my experience, I'd say like a dexmedetomidine and a butorphanol is up there in the most commonly used sedation protocols. So if the dog's sedated, lubricate the eye. If you're doing a spay, that's why we lubricate the eye. There was a study showing that there were at least corneal erosions in an excessive number of back dogs because hemilams take longer than most of the other procedures that we're doing, and they weren't repeating application of the lubricant. Topical or systemic atropine, because that's a parasympatholytic, probably clinically insignificant, but always something to think about. Overall, if you give your patient drugs to sedate or do any anesthetic procedure, lubricate the eyes. It takes 4 seconds, and it's never, you can't over lubricate an eye.
Nope.
Is there a specific lubrication that you like?
I really like Optics Care or Gentile Gel for like my clinical cases, but for my like anesthetic cases, like a spay, use something like a Paralube, something really thick that's not going to really slide off. Owners don't traditionally like the Paralube and it interferes with vision. Like a Gentile Gel or Optics Care is almost like a hydrogel. The dog's not going to have any change to its vision, but I'd say some kind of petroleum-based ointment for anesthetic procedures.
So let's talk about treatments then for chronic KCS.
I always explain it to owners, there's two wings of treatment. There's lacromimetic, which is taking the place of tears, and there's lacrostimulant, which is encouraging tear production. And I already mentioned Gentile Gel and Optics Care, my favorite lacromimetic therapies. You cannot over lubricate an eye. I have literally told owners, if you put this in once an hour, that's fine, but don't put it in twice a day. We need more.
Right. I always say every time you look at your dog, just put the Optics Care.
I'm definitely stealing that. That's great. Every time your dog looks at you, know that it's time for another dose.
Exactly. Yep.
So lacrostimulant, there's a few different reported mechanisms, but honestly, at the end of the day, it's not really well understood. There is the FDA-approved product, 0.2% cyclosporine, which is labeled as Optimmune, which is an ointment. So that is a calcineurin inhibitor. Basically, that's going to work by blocking IL-2, which is going to be an inflammatory cytokine, inhibiting T-cell, both helper and cytotoxic. And there is a direct action on tear production by binding a certain receptor in the gland. Calcineurin inhibitors are also thought to decrease corneal pigmentation and improve conjunctival goblet cell mucin secretion. So hopefully you get better quality tears.
So if you're starting with that and it doesn't seem to be working, how long do you give it before you make a change to something else?
I always tell owners, recheck tears after starting a lacquer stimulant therapy, recheck tears in 4 to 6 weeks. If I have a dog that comes in with a Schirmer tear test of zero, again, I do legally feel obligated to try the FDA-approved product first. As long as you're coupling it with a lacromimetic therapy, that dog's going to be better off.
Right.
But I, in that scenario where I really don't think this is going to be enough, I think I'm going to need to bump it up, I'm going to have them come back in a month. If we don't see what we want, then we talk about compounded medications.
So you're saying off-label, there's some other available options.
Yes. You can mess around with varying concentrations of cyclosporin. If Optimmune doesn't work, I'm going to make one of two pivots. I'm going to do a 2% cyclosporin, which I believe the studies show that 82% of dogs are going to respond to that. Now, I couldn't find in the studies what the concentration was in that, but I can say anecdotally and just overall from experience, if a veterinary ophthalmologist is dispensing cyclosporin, it's likely going to be, they're going to start with a 2% because Optimmune did not work. Mm-hmm. Then you move to your second option, which is a considerably more potent calcineurin inhibitor, which is tacrolimus. And that's going to be a 0.03%. I reserve that for patients that didn't respond to cyclosporin. And I'll be the first one to tell you, if I have a Shih Tzu that has completely black corneas, tons of vessels, mucoid discharge, Schirmer tear test is zero, and checks every single box, I'm not above starting them on tacrolimus right away.
I agree. I will say anecdotally, and I haven't, you know, studied this, I will always start with Optimmune too, and I've never kept a dog on Optimmune. Like, I've always had to compound higher strengths of cyclosporin or tacrolimus, and tacrolimus has been the most successful that I've seen.
I would agree with you, and I would say my success with Optimmune tends to be in certain other corneal diseases in cats.
Interesting.
Yeah, like I always start my eosinophilic keratitis cats on Optimmune. That'll be for a future episode. But
can't wait.
Oh, it's going to be so good because that's one of my favorite corneal diseases.
Ew.
I know, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the I will talk to them. Sometimes owners are like, use what you know is going to work. And that's when I'm going to start out at a 2% cyclosporin. Now, this is actually, I believe that this is one of the scenarios where human medicine took a page out of the veterinary medical book. And that's how they developed Restasis, which I believe is a 0.02% cyclosporin.
It is. Yeah.
So humans are far more sensitive to this medication than dogs.
Got it. Interesting.
All right. So Casey, you've talked about compounded medications and your first line medications. What are some alternate therapies?
So kind of circling back to our neurogenic KCS, that's when we talk about pilocarpine, a cholinergic agonist, a parasympathomimetic, so the opposite of atropine. So pilocarpine, cholinergic agonist, parasympathomimetic.
And you're always punting this to the ophthalmologist anyway to deal with.
I'm punting this. So pilocarpine is the ideal treatment. It can be an oral or topical administration. It's irritating. I'm not going to go into treatment because I don't want to.
We won't be able to keep it to under 30 minutes then.
Yeah, exactly. That's my answer. I do like using an anti-inflammatory in cases of keratitis. Now, you have to use this with caution for the main reason is these patients are markedly predisposed to corneal ulceration. Mm-hmm. So you start a dog on Neopolydex, which is going to be the most common steroid-containing product in veterinary hospitals. It ulcerates. Owner doesn't know because the dog's already squinting because of the KCS. And then you end up with a much bigger eye-threatening problem. I will frequently do a diclofenac or a flurbiprofen because it's a bit safer and it does accomplish to a lesser extent the same goals. Another thing I will do for at least like maybe a 2-week course is going to be something like a Neopolyvac. Mm. Always Q8. I mean, if you have like that really nasty, severe mucopurulent discharge, possible bacterial infection. So I would do that. And if, of course, if you have a periocular dermatitis, proceed as you would with any skin case, do a skin cytology, confirm infection, and you can do something like a cefadoxime or a cefalexin. I think that's going to cover your dermatitis as well. Now, I do know that some people will use acetylcysteine, which is a mucolytic.
Yeah.
I've never have, and I do know that it's toxic to the epithelium.
Mm.
Lastly, whenever people think of cyclosporin, they're not going to think of eyes. They're probably going to think of Atopica.
Yeah.
Have I seen people dispense Atopica for dry eye? I have. I don't think that the study was ever green-lighted, or I don't think he could get the numbers to prove that oral cyclosporin works.
Hmm.
I would never do that. Systemic consequences of cyclosporin are considerable. And if we have a much safer topical, I would go for that.
Yeah.
Back to topical, I have a question then.
Yeah.
So for the periocular dermatitis, can you use topical treatments around the eye that are non-irritating?
I guess it would depend on the severity and kind of how large the region is. If it's a small little like eyelid margin blepharitis and kind of like a bacterial, if it's a staphylococcal infection or what have you, I don't think a topical eye ointment is wrong. But if the dog has no hair and really red eyelids, and I'm going oral for sure.
Good to know.
Then lastly, here's something that people don't do, and I guess I don't understand why they don't do it. And I will preface that with, I don't do it. But there was a study out of NC State, I believe in like 2000, where they did show that oral alpha interferon between 20 and 40 IU once a day caused an increase in tear production in 55% of their population. These dogs were not on, I believe, were not on any topicals.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it done by one ophthalmologist. I believe I mentioned him in my in the glaucoma lecture, Dave Ramsey. He actually did it topically, loved oral interferon. And the guy who did this study is like one of the gods of veterinary ophthalmology. Brian Gilger is his name.
He's from NC State.
NC State.
Yeah.
I got to meet him. I did an ophtho externship at NC State. And he was mainly working with the horses.
He wrote the equine ophthalmology book.
Yeah. It was cool to meet him.
He's a really smart guy.
Can we just talk about how much you guys just fanboyed out about like a veterinary ophthalmologist?
That is true.
There's not that many of them though.
I mean, imagine if I met Kirk Gillette, like it's over for me. That's the coolest moment of my life.
How frequently are you prescribed? Like what's the dosing frequency for some of these topicals?
Unless they are overproducing tears, 90% of my patients are going to go on a Q12 or twice a day administration. And in a moderately controlled KCS patient, I'll probably do a 3 to 4 times a day gentle gel or optics care. If I put a dog on tacrolimus, say it's one of those cases where tear production is zero and I'm like, oh, this is not going to respond. I got to put it on tacrolimus and it comes back just pouring tears, I might move it to a once a day tacrolimus.
Mm.
That's happened to me a few times.
Wow.
And I was like, maybe I was a little too aggressive on this one, but
no, it worked.
Move them back to once a day.
Hey, but you solved the problem.
Everyone's happy.
You did.
Yeah. Everyone's happy.
All right, cool.
I can't ignore surgical management.
Oh yeah. Tell us more about that.
So there's the parotid duct transposition. I think it's gross. That's where you're actually rerouting the parotid duct to empty into the eye.
But this is a salvage procedure.
This is a salvage procedure. I've seen it done a few times. There's two different methods. There's the open and the closed. But basically anything that makes the dog salivate is going to look like the dog is crying. So every time the dog eats, it's going to pour tears. It's going to get severe periocular dermatitis. A lot of people simply say, I don't recommend it, but people will do it.
Interesting.
But if you want to, like, one thing to not screw up in a dog is the parotid duct. So, like, I wouldn't be so bold to, like, do that.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, what's the alternative when it's uncontrolled and they're getting ulcers all the time? I mean, you just, enucleation would be the next step?
If the eye's not there, you're not going to have problems with the eye.
So sad.
Which is unfortunately, like, the end stage for, like, 75% of ophthalmology.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's a tough one. That's, if you cannot control the dry eye, the animal's miserable. It's PDT, once an hour lubricant. Mm. It's tough. That's a tough call to make.
Yeah.
But probably by that time, the dog can't see, to be perfectly honest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What's the function of the eye to see? If it can't do that, why is it there? And if it's just causing pain,
yeah,
I would consider an end-stage procedure in that scenario. I've never done it, but we're there to be advocates for the patient, and I feel like that is actively being an advocate for the patient. There are some studies talking about cyclosporine implants. I know more commonly they're doing them in horses, and I think there was a study where they did them in like a wolf in a zoo where no one could give him eye meds. Mm. So they implanted they had a cyclosporine implant that they put in.
Cool.
And I think it worked. I'm far enough out of the game where I don't know if people are actively doing that, but I thought it was cool back then.
You can Google that one too.
Yeah. As far as long-term, you know, the question of how do I monitor these guys? After you start them, recheck 4 to 6 weeks after the medication is started. If it's not increased by 10 millimeters per minute, and that's not a hard and fast rule, but at least you want an increase in your shimmer and you want a clinical improvement, you move forward. My somewhat of an algorithm is Optimmune to 2% cyclosporine to 0.3 tacrolimus, tweak as necessary. If it's over 20, or there's just such considerable wetting, like I mentioned earlier, decrease the Q24. You can find the algorithm that I just mentioned on todaysveterinarypractice.com.
Okay. Interesting. I've never been able to decrease meds to Q24.
Two or three times I've done it.
But maybe, like, you know, you don't know what people are doing when you tell them to give it
twice. Oh, for sure.
Maybe they are giving it for once a day.
I think owner compliance is probably one of the biggest reasons for KCS treatment failure.
So tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I know we didn't talk about this, but for pet owners out there, what breeds would you say are the key offenders here?
Anecdotally, I see dry eye in a lot of Shih Tzus.
Mm-hmm.
There are other contributors to keratitis in the Shih Tzu, like a lag ophthalmos or something like that. But I see a lot of Shih Tzus with dry eye. Schnauzers, Yorkies.
English Bulldogs?
Yeah, thank you. I can't believe I missed that one. English Bulldogs. Maybe, like, most English Bulldogs.
I mean, their eyes are just so messed up with all their folds. And
also, by, like, 8 months, they've got, like, all the problems. They don't waste any time to have issues.
It's so bad.
But their problems just get worse, too. I mean, they just get worse.
No, they're all just manageable. You can't solve any of the... Maybe some of the... components of brachycephalic upper airway syndrome, but like a lot of the stuff is just giving them meds to take care of it.
I mean, the corkscrew tail, the entropion,
intertrigo, the otitis, the pyodermas. So I guess I will end with a fairly straightforward algorithm, which I did take off a Veterinary Partner to have for my citation there. If you have a dog presenting with keratitis, inflammation of the cornea, you do a shimmer tear test.
Wait, what does that look like?
Keratitis?
Yeah.
Oh, neovascularization, mucopurulent discharge, sometimes blepharospasm, variably corneal edema, which I didn't mention earlier, pigmentation.
Conjunctivitis,
good one, because the conjunctiva relies on tears as well. But we'll say a dog comes in with keratitis and you're like, I think this is dry eye. If the shimmer tear test is above 15, consider other differentials or a qualitative KCS. Other differentials would be like pannus. If it's a German Shepherd, be thinking pannus. Pigmentary keratitis, that's going to be your pug. Entropion, I think, is very underdiagnosed. And Lagophthalmos, which Lagophthalmos is inability to completely close the eyelids. And I think that's something that Shih Tzus combat because they have such shallow orbits.
Can I add another couple in there?
Please do.
Dystichia. And what's the other one where they get like a weird eyelash like on the inside?
The ectopic cilia.
Ectopic cilia, thank you.
So I would say the difference between those, the number one presenting concern with dystichia is going to be epiphora. It's basically a tickling of the cornea causing increased tearing. Ectopic cilia is going to be an ulcer in a fairly characteristic spot. Mm. A lot of times it's linear, mm-hmm. up and down, and it's going to be at probably the top 50% of the cornea.
Interesting.
If you're a general practitioner and you send an ectopic cilia, they're going to be impressed because it's missed a lot.
I'm sure.
It's missed a lot by veterinary ophthalmologists as well. If it's a non-pigmented hair, I've seen dogs go to surgery to go under an operating microscope just to search for an ectopic cilia because it's so strongly suspected, but they simply can't find it with their slit lamp.
That's good to know because I always feel really inadequate when I can't find stuff like that. So it's good to know. Thank you.
I missed one about a year ago in a 10-year-old dog. I was like, yeah, I missed it. But like, how did it become clinical for an ectopic cilia at 10? So that was a whoopsie on my part. Anyway, so that's your above 15. If it's 10 to 15, predisposed breed, I'd start therapy. If it's a breed not predisposed, what I might do is maybe start something like a Gentile gel or optics care to make sure it's comfortable. Repeat Schirmer tear test in a month. Maybe you're dealing with one of the intermittent KCSs, but it's hard to say. And also go back to the other causes of keratitis.
Right, because it's a lifelong therapy. So you don't want to start them on something if it's intermittent.
Lifelong therapy. And it's really hard to say, yeah, I started on this therapy that I told you is going to be lifelong. But let's rock the boat. Let's stop it and I'll see you in a month. That's a hard sell and something I don't want to do. So I want to make sure if I'm going to initiate a lifelong therapy that I'm sure. It's like starting amlodipine.
Right. Yep.
If you don't want to take them off once you start. If it's below 10, start therapy.
Mm-hmm. So would you recommend, and I know we're going to have a whole episode on what meds you should keep in your GP hospital, but at least an optics care and Optimmune, the FDA approved, to start those two.
Yep.
You would at least recommend those two to keep.
Yep. I would keep, I mean, you're going to get more uses than you know out of Optimmune. And you're going to get more uses than you really realize out of an optics care. It's a catch-all. And overall, it's just nice to have the owner get the diagnosis and leave with the treatment as opposed to the other options.
Agreed.
One thing I would also say about optics care is Casey, you and I were both at the Chicago Vet.
Yeah.
And they had a booth, the optics care people. And they've got like 5 or 6 different types now of optics care.
There's so many. And they all have like a really pretty, they have like pretty colors on their boxes.
Yeah. He gave me samples of everything. So I've got it all.
They're all great.
But anyway, we could talk about that when we go through what to keep in the practice.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
Awesome.
All right. Well, that was great. What's the next topic we're going to do?
Is it feline ophthalmology?
I think we should do feline.
Yeah, we should definitely do cats. You know, I love cats. All right. Well, thank you so much, Casey. It was great to have you. And the name of this episode is going to be Casey-S.
I love it.
Casey-S.
Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
We hope you enjoyed this episode on the IndieVets Happy Hour. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends. And if you like us, leave us a 5-star review and make sure to subscribe so you can be alerted whenever we have a new episode. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at clinical@indievets.com. Also, to learn more about us and how we're making vet med better, head to indievets.com. That's IndieVets.com. While you're there, be sure to head to our blog for the latest stories and tips from our doctors. And lastly, if you're interested in joining our amazing IndieVets team, please email Dr. Andrew Heller at andrew@indievets.com. See you next time. Cheers. Cheers.
I'm a veterinarian, sure, but I'm way more than that. I'm also a tango dancer, a struggling but determined pie maker, and a mom. With IndieVets, I get to choose when and where I work. I create my own schedule and choose shifts at nearby animal hospitals that are right for me. Having that flexibility is exactly what I need to have plenty of time for all those other things that I am. Because I'm more than just a vet. Visit IndieVets.com to learn more and apply.